I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story. We have a very special treat for you today, an exclusive interview with the renowned author Salman Rushdie. The Indian-born, New York-based writer of the Booker Prize-winning Midnight's Children and controversial The Satanic Verses has been venerated in literary circles for decades. Now he tells Guardian Australia's assistant news editor, Shelley Hepworth, that he's publishing his next book on the popular newsletter website Substack. Today, being a writer in the digital age with Salman Rushdie.
So, Salman, how did the idea of starting a newsletter with Substack come about?
Well, they just wrote to me. They wrote to Andrew Wiley, and then he wrote to me and said, "Do you really want to do this?" And I said, "I don't know, but maybe." I didn't know what it was. So I sort of started looking into it. I found that some people I knew were already doing it, seemed to be having, I gather Patti Smith is publishing a book on it. And very recently, I don't know if you're familiar with the Israeli writer Edgar Keret, but he's a very brilliant, witty, kind of funny writer. He's very friendly with Gary Steingart, and they're kind of like in the same bag, if you know what I mean. He's like an Israeli Gary Steingart, or Gary is a Russian-American Edgar Keret. And he started doing it, and I've been looking at his Substack, and it's so witty and enjoyable, and he's clearly having a wonderful time doing it. And I thought, oh, well, okay, maybe I can do that. So it happened, it was serendipitous, really. The invitation to have a go at it came at a moment when I was trying to think about what I might do that I hadn't done before.
Can you tell me what you've got planned for your Substack newsletter?
Yes, well, you know, it's a new thing for everybody, so I'm going to kind of make it up as I go along, but I have some starting points. During this now 18 months or so of pandemic, I've watched a lot of movies, and one of the things I decided to do as a kind of program was to watch again all the films I watched when I was young and falling in love with the movies. You know, the French New Wave, the Italian New Wave, all the other great filmmakers of that period of the 60s and 70s. And just to see what happened if I watched all these films again. I mean, would they mean the same thing to me or not? And it was very interesting to see what in my view held up and what did not. And so I thought I want to talk about filmmakers and filmmaking. I'll talk about books because books is what I do. And I'm going to talk about anything else that comes to mind. You know, I mean, I've sort of in my mind said to myself that I don't really want to use it as a political platform. Because I think what happens is that takes over and obliterates everything else. And I'd quite like to, I mean, it may be in the end that something happens, e.g. Afghanistan, that might force me to say something. But the purpose of doing this is really more broadly speaking, cultural than political, you know. So, somebody was asking me earlier about music, you know, and I hadn't thought about writing about music, but now that it's been put in my head, I might do that. What I'm going to do is use it to put up some new fiction. I have a file of short stories that I've sort of, which I just have all the time that I work on occasionally, and they're in sort of different stages of finish. And I think in this launch period of this launch week, I think I'll certainly put up at least one short story. Well, the story I'm thinking of publishing is a friend of mine, a French-American photographer called Simon Chaput, did a beautiful series of photographs of these extraordinary buildings in India called the Jantar Mantar, which are kind of like steady state observatories, sundials, and all just surrealist looking buildings. There were originally five of them. One was destroyed. There's still four. The most famous two is one in Delhi and there's one in Jaipur. Anyway, he did these beautiful, beautiful photographs of those buildings. And said, would I do something to go with them? So I wrote a short story about them. And his book was it's an art photography book, and it was published, I think, in an edition of 100 copies. You know, and that's the only life that story has had. I thought I might give it some extra life here. And I asked him, which he's very kindly agreed, if I could also put in some of the photographs that he took. So I'm going to do that, I mean, either in the next few days. But I also have this, again, one of these projects I've been kicking around in the back of my head for a long time, which comes back to what we were saying about movies, that I wanted to write about movies in a fiction way as well. And I had this text, let's call it, about a film director and an actress slash muse of the kind of, you know, Truffaut, Jean Moreau, you know, Godard, Anna Karenina kind of relationship. And I wanted to write a story about them, which felt like, almost which felt like a new wave movie, with all the, with, you know, techniques of the new wave, of disjunctions and crash cuts and gangsters. Anyway, I wrote this thing and I kind of didn't like it. And so I never really did anything with it. And what I've done lately, inspired by this project, is to revisit it and tear it apart and reshape the storyline somewhat and cut it in half, so that what was originally a text of a give or take like 60,000 words is now probably 35,000 words, and a lot better for it. You know, for me, the infallible test of anything I write is embarrassment. If I'm embarrassed to show it to you, then it's not ready. And there comes a point where I'm not embarrassed to show it, where actually I'm kind of eager to show it, you know. And I, after this complete rethinking of this text, as I say, compressing, condensing, cutting, and changing the narrative line somewhat, what I'm going to do is to publish it in serial form, sort of roughly speaking, like once a week. Currently looking at it, I seem to have it in 49 pieces. And some of them are longish, some of them are shortish, but I thought, you know, I'll just put up a piece every week. And it reminded me of the way in which, you know, the way in which fiction used to be published, which was in serial form. And I always remember reading that when Richardson was publishing Clarissa in chapters, you know, his readers expected, in a way, that she would, in the end, fall in love with the guy, you know, but then he rapes her. Had quite a lot of correspondence from readers who said that, you know, in spite of that terrible act, you know, they still wanted what they would consider to be a happy ending. And he very determinedly would not give it to them. So I thought, okay, that, how interesting if that starts happening. That's to say, if readers start responding to the text as it's being published and have thoughts about it, you know, now, I mean, I can ignore those thoughts or I can not ignore them, but it'll be quite interesting to have that. I've never had that before, to have, to be publishing something where people can say things about it while it's going on.
Do you have a sense of whether you might respond to that, or are you determined to run it out the way it's written now?
I'm actually quite open-minded about it. It would have to be a very good suggestion, you know. But it does sometimes happen that somebody says something about a character or something which you hadn't thought about when you were writing it. And you think, oh, I wish I'd thought that when I was writing it. And so I'm leaving that possibility open. I mean, I'm not expecting to do any major rewriting. But if somebody were to say, for instance, oh, that's interesting, I want to hear a bit more about that, then maybe I'll give them a bit more about that. I mean, that's going to be probably the biggest single project that I know that I'm going to do. And then we'll see, you know. I mean, I've got very attracted to the idea recently, in this strange hour year and a half, of trying out things I've never done before. I mean, writers are, you know, pushed inwards anyway, but this has been, it's not just your professional life, it's your whole life, you know, that everybody's life has been pushed in that direction. And it just, yeah, it just made me think, you know, I published this book of essays and that's the 20th book, you know, and I'm already writing the 21st book, which is a novel, which is kind of halfway through. And I just thought, do something else, you know? And exactly the moment that I was thinking that, this project cropped up.
And you sort of talked in your first post about having a conversation with readers. How do you see that playing out, in comments or via reply emails?
Well, I think some of all of that I've been taught about. You know, I'm not the world's most tech-savvy human being. You know, I'm not completely ignorant, but I'm not, like, sophisticated about it. But they've been showing me how I could set up a conversation thread, you know, where I could ask a question about maybe even a question about something that I've written or something that's going on, you know, and just say, let's have a chat about it. And then I can jump in there every couple of days and see what people are saying and reply. And again, there's a bit of this that I don't know. I mean, I'm either going to get a lot of mail or none, you know, and if there's a lot of mail, I might institute some kind of a mailbag, you know, where every so often I kind of dip into the letters and pull out a few and talk about them. So I sort of thought that Twitter might be that, but Twitter isn't that. I mean, one of the reasons that I started a Twitter account was that people said to me it would be a way of having a direct conversation with readers. People don't use it like that.
And I guess it's also a group discussion, whereas when you have a comment thread or an email, it's more of a one-on-one conversation.
Exactly. And you have more length, you know. I mean, there's only so much you can say at Twitter length. And there are subjects which sometimes I've been asked about on Twitter, which are just too big to discuss in tweets. So there's an advantage just being able to talk in just being able to say more. As I say, I'm somewhat feeling my way, and I'm going to see how it goes. But all of these things are things that I'm open to. I have a sort of thread that I'm thinking of developing, which is just called My Most Interesting Literary Encounters. Mm. You know, just people I've met, you know, and what they said. I mean, like, once in my life I met Graham Greene. I had lunch with him, and it was very enjoyable, and I thought people might like to hear about that. And there are lots of other writers that, you know, the world of books is not so big. So if you hang around in it for any length of time, you bump into lots of people. And I just thought it might be interesting, even just at the level of anecdote and gossip, to tell stories about writers that I've met, as long as they're not defamatory.
So you've said your Substack is an experiment in conversation and form, but is it also an experiment in financial terms, in terms of how writers get paid for their work?
Well, it might be. I mean, I'm a great believer in expecting nothing, you know, and then if something good happens, then you can be pleased. But I gather, particularly from journalist colleagues, that it's been very valuable to journalists, especially journalists who like to work in long form. Because, as you know, I'm sure that the places where you can put long form journalism are shrinking every year. So the fact that this is opening, I think, has been very valuable to quite a few journalists. And I think they're actually making some serious money, which also for journalists is a good thing.
Next, freedom of speech and the potential of tech platforms for writers.
I guess this is a topic that sort of follows you around, but most of the big tech platforms have come under fire over questions surrounding freedom of speech and content moderation, and Substack is no different. How do you feel about wading into that?
You know, I mean, I'm interested in freedom of speech, and I don't exactly see how Substack does anything different than anyone else. You know, and I just think I think, as I was saying already, for a number of journalists, I know that it's actually given them a freedom that they might not find if they were required to pass the various gatekeepers who control what can be published and not published and at what length. You know, I mean, I see that people like Michael Moore have a Substack, you know, and I can imagine that would be very popular. And I can see it as actually being valuable. I mean, I teach long-form journalism. I mean, I'm in the journalism school at NYU, and I teach a graduate seminar in narrative nonfiction, which is usually book length, you know. And one of the things the students ask is, how are they supposed to be able to do this? you know, because there's, with the exception of the New Yorker and one or two other places, that there's so few places where you can put this. And I, one of the things that's happened, I said, and I say to the class, is that it's forced people to book length. Mm. It's forced people to have book proposals that they sell to a publisher, not to a newspaper. And that's the only way in which they can make it possible to both finance and to actually publish long-form nonfiction. So if this is another such, let's say, publishing venue, I mean, I think that's a good thing. I don't have any... I mean, I've seen one or two articles which claim that it's in some way evil. I don't actually even understand how.
I think the question is probably over when platforms start paying people and who they're paying and who they're platforming and what sort of voices are rising to the top and whether they have a duty to be transparent about that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that that's any different than publishers, really. You know, I mean, publishing does exactly the same thing. You know, you could argue about who gets to be published and the question about what voices get to speak, which I mean, I think is a very important question. And one of the things that's been interesting in book publishing in the last, let's say, the last decade, is that there was a real problem about which voices got to speak. And I'm not saying that's gone away, but it's changing. The level, and certainly I'm a bit out of the loop in England, so I don't exactly know what's going on, but here there's a lot more space for writers of color than there used to be, both as books, as publishing books, and in the critical sphere and so on, you know. So and also in terms of who is employed in publishing companies, and potentially something like this with its lack of gatekeepers could also enable a more diverse set of voices to speak. Mm. And then my understanding is if you want a Substack, you can start one. You know, you don't have to be invited. So I mean, I don't want to be their cheerleader, you know. My view is it was interesting to me to have a go at this. And all I've done is make a 12-month commitment. And a year from now, I'm gonna see where we stand. And I'll either go on with it or I won't.
Yeah.
You write very poetically in your first Substack post about how stories give birth to other stories. Do you think there's a sense these days, particularly online, that the birth rate of stories is increasing?
I think that new technology always makes possible new art forms. And I think literature has not found its new form in this digital age. You know, many of the other arts, I think, have. There's been very successful work by many leading visual artists. David Hockney uses iPads, you know, very, very skillfully. And also in music and in film and et cetera, you can see that the way in which this new technology is being used is quite original and innovative. You know, in the area of storytelling and literature, et cetera, I mean, I think we haven't got there yet. You know, whatever the new thing is that's going to arise out of this new world, I don't think we've seen it yet. I have a very strong suspicion it is not going to be somebody of my age who comes up with it.
Stories have many functions. They can bring people together, but they can also divide people into tribes. What for you is the function of storytelling?
I think it's has always been for human beings one of the most natural ways in which we try to understand the world. We are narrative creatures. We are ourselves a narrative. You know, we are born, we live, and we die. So we have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so story, a thing which has a beginning, a middle, and an end, feels to us like us. Yeah. And I think that means that human beings have always been storytellers. You know, and you use that as a way of understanding who you are and who the people around you are and what's going on. And so, I mean, just speaking for me as a writer, that's how I've always used it. It's my way of responding to wherever I happen to be in life and in the world. And, you know, it's here I am at this point now. And what do I think? And that journey, which is now getting on to be a long time, I mean, if I look back, which I don't very often, but the books do seem to me like reports from different stages of my consciousness, if you know what I mean. And I think all of us do that. I mean, we tell each other stories. It's not talking about publishing things. I mean, we all tell each other stories all the time. And some of them are true and some of them are not true. But we do it to explain ourselves and to explain the world to ourselves. And I think that's why the thing survives. You know, people have been talking about the death of the novel almost since the birth of the novel. And the reason things like novels survive is that they fulfill this need. People like them. I remember when ebooks arrived, there was this panic in the publishing industry that this was going to be the end, you know, everything was over. And ebooks kind of rocketed up to about 16 or 17% of the market and then just stalled. And they've never gone up above that. You know, and there's quite a lot of evidence to say that they actually increased the total size of the market. That there are people who would not go into a bookstore who might download a book online. But the actual old-fashioned thing, the hard copy book, is incredibly mutinously alive. And I mean, here I am having another go at, I guess, killing it.
Do you think you might release the novella as a hard copy at a later date?
Well, let's see how it goes. The only thing they ask, Substack, is that it should remain only on the Substack site for 1 year.
Okay. So just one other question. I've actually been reading your 1982 essay, Imaginary Homelands, and you wrote that India, the one that you left, is different to the India of those who stayed, and it lives on in your imagination. Do you think online communities can become like that? Places that shape us and our identities and live on in our minds in a nostalgic way?
I think that's. I mean, I find, for example, that on Twitter, I have a very disproportionate number of Indian followers. You know, there's a very large Indian following in that, whatever it is, 1.1 million people. I've never quantified it, but I certainly in terms of who's active on my Twitter feed, the Indian followers are by far the most active. And it does become a way for me, sitting in New York, to have a conversation with people across India, you know, as if I was there. You know, I mean, I remain very engaged with what's going on in India. I mean, both politically, but also, of course, this tragedy of the coronavirus there. So, yeah, it does create that community. And this might allow a slightly more complex connection. We'll see. As I say, I'm just, you know, I'm diving in here. And que sera, sera. You know, it'll either turn out to be something wonderful and enjoyable, or it won't.
That was Salman Rushdie in conversation with Guardian Australia's Shelley Hepworth. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria and Jane Lee. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Laura Murphy-Oates, and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Okay, see you back here tomorrow.